Welcome to the Fly Culture Podcast, bringing you interviews, reviews, and fishing tips. Here's your host, Pete Tigus.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Fly Culture Podcast. I don't know if you're like me, but I seem to have slipped seamlessly from my trout season into the grayling season. Things come and happen at a slightly different pace, that they seem to be more sociable affairs. And yesterday I was out fishing with some friends. The wind was blowing. The leaves were falling into the river. That's my excuse for the fishing being a little bit tough. But we sat around for hours talking, chewing the fat, putting the world to rights. And they're those sort of perfect days that you love out on the water. I'm really pleased to report my friend Luke saved us all embarrassment. It was about 4:30, and he stood heron-like in the river, determined to catch a grayling on a dry fly, saw a rise, cast to it, and caught the fish, which was absolutely fantastic. So really, really pleased about that. Today, I'm really pleased to be joined by someone who's a journalist. He is a TV presenter, vice president of the Wild Trout Trust, and a passionate fly angler. It's Matthew Wright. Matthew, it's great to have you here. How are you doing?
It's great to be here, Pete. The miracles of modern technology, eh? The virus may try and shut us down, but the computers cannot stop us communicating. Or can they?
They've had a pretty good go, haven't they? We've had a few technical issues, but I'm really pleased that we've got there at the end. But how's everything? How's your life in London? And how's the fishing been for you this year? Because obviously it's been a very strange and weird season. How's it been for you?
It's been as strange as it possibly could be, really. I always feel bad when I say this, but it is the truth that in many ways, for me, lockdown has been a really positive thing because I really was having a lot of problems with the old mental health and all kind of just really all over the place. And I needed a break, and I was planning on having one at the beginning of April, and I ended up having one starting about 10 days earlier. Being at home, more time with my, well, she's growing up fast now, nearly two, but more time with this sort of baby daughter. And I think having a child was quite a big thing for me, first time at 54 as I was then. And it all just was too much, really. And having time to recalibrate quietly at home at the beginning of the season came, I'd normally be fishing, but I think I was okay at home. And then when the season sort of got underway, I suppose back into June, really, for me, I had a lovely day, the last day of the Mayfly, literally the last day of the Mayfly at Amwell Magna on the Lee, because I went back the next day because I enjoyed it so much there wasn't anything happening at all. And then some wonderful weeks down in Devon during the sort of high summer, and then ended up at the Derbyshire Y for last dibs of the season with the wonderful John Beer. So nowhere near as much fishing as I would normally do. I'm very lucky, but I would also be planning some bone fishing at Christmas, and that's gone by the by. In fact, gone by the by for the foreseeable future at the moment. Mixed blessings, but overall, the fishing I've done has been wonderful.
And it's a real mixture of stuff that you've done, which sounds fascinating. Again, it's interesting that you touch on Devon, which is my neck of the woods, obviously, and then Amwell Magna, which I know well. And it's funny you say about that last day of the Mayfly. And funnily enough, somebody who used to be a member of the Amwell Magna as well, and I was fishing the Wiley, which again I think you fish in the same place. And I hit a blue-winged olive hatch, which the like I've never seen. There were fish rising everywhere, and it was 10 o'clock at night, and I'd never seen, and it was one of those fabled hatches that you dream of. And I phoned up my friend, and I knew he was around, and I said, you must come down. And he came down. I said, it'll happen. 9:30, nothing. 10 o'clock, nothing. And it's funny how those things, and it makes you savor those moments even more, I think, doesn't it?
Yes, I think as these things happen to you in life, they go away in the little mental notebook, don't they? And I can remember actually the very first Mayfly hatch I encountered was on the River Test, and it was ironically the kind of Mayfly hatch that everybody sort of talks about. I mean, I had them crawling all over my hair, in my ears, everywhere. I mean, there were millions of them, and the fishing was so ridiculously easy. And I went, I think probably the next two or three times I went back to the Test that time, the Mayfly was still quite strong and it was still quite easy. And I know everybody says Duffer's Fortnight and everything else, but I didn't really get much of a buzz from it, if I'm honest, at all. And I used to find people talking about mayflies. Like, come on, it's much more interesting to try different flies and different techniques rather than just catch fish. Then you mentioned the Wiley. I hold my hand up. I'm a very keen angler, but there are some serious anglers, and I would count you amongst them. Peter Hayes is another. And yeah, I know my limitations. And quite frankly, if it wasn't for mayfly on the Wiley, I would really struggle to actually identify where the decent fish are, because I don't get enough time on the river to learn. And it is a river where if you don't have the knowledge, as it can be very hard. There's very little to see on the Wilson Stretch. It's dark and quite fast flowing and apparently featureless. So, it's a really difficult river, I have to say.
And that's part of the charm of it, isn't it? And you've sort of alluded to that as well about, you know, mayfly time and everything else. And for me, that's one of the big, you know, you think you know a little bit sometimes. And then and yesterday was the classic case, you know, and I thought, well, this is, and I said to my friend Gerald at the time, I said, this is one of those pools that I think if you had to fish one for the rest of your life, I'd fish it. You know, if you had one spot you had to be in, that would feature in that list of top 3, 4, 5, whatever. It was beautiful. Didn't catch a bloody thing in there, but I'd love to go back and try it again. And that's for me, and it sounds similar for you as well, that's part of the challenge, isn't it? To try and learn something, to try and get a little bit better and try and get a small handle on what's actually going on there to understand it a little bit more, I guess.
I think you, when I learned shorthand, the teacher said at the beginning, she said, everyone's going to get up to sort of 40 words a minute quite quickly. Then it's going to take quite a grind to get up to 60 words a minute. And I think you had to get 80 or 100 words a minute to pass the test. And she said, and then you'll all plateau. You just nothing, there won't be any improvement at all. You won't go up a word or two for about 3-4 weeks. And she said, and then it will race away. And that's how that's exactly what it was like learning shorthand. And I think I would say that my fly fishing is definitely, it's periods of plateauing and then stage learning. That day on the thinking Duffer's Fortnight was just about taking fish, was how I saw it at the time on the test. Now I look at it on the Wiley as it's a key. It becomes a key. It's no longer about catching the fish. It's a key of learning where the fish are. So that's a stage up. And if we're going to talk about pools that we would always go back to, I've got a favourite stretch, a bend on the River Usk. And I absolutely love it. I've had days there that have just been just beyond belief. You can't believe that one river can have so many huge brown trout. It's just extraordinary. My wife has a photo of one of hers at Gliffy's Hotel, a very, very nice trout indeed. And it's actually the biggest one either of us have caught in a non-competitive fishing relationship. And I've been back, apart from this year, every summer in August to try and catch one as big or bigger than Amelia's, and never got one. I have had evenings there where I have really learnt the lesson about matching the hatch and how tricky it can be. Just in terms of a sort of stage learning, I had three evenings, late afternoons, evenings there. And for 2 4/5 of them, I didn't raise a fish, despite the fact there were fish coming up all the time. And the problem, and I've still not really unpicked it, the problem was every species of fly that I could identify was in the air in huge, huge quantities, everything. Everything was hatching. And I couldn't work out. I thought I'll start methodically and I'll work my way through. And eventually I got to Iron Blues. And it was getting quite late on the third and final day, probably about 8 o'clock. And I put the Iron Blue on and I just sort of chucked the leader in at this point. I hadn't even just prepping for the cast. And blow me, a fish came up for it straight away. And I thought, is this the king? I got about three more casts in, and every fish was 20 inches. And it was just, wow. These are the magic days. But by God, the nights before, you just start thinking, I'm useless. I know nothing. I've learned nothing. How can it be this hard?
Yeah, it's lovely how you rationalize it and the way that you think, well, it might have been this. And you end up almost overthinking it, don't you? That it is just too much. And you sort of anthropomorphize the fish a bit too much. Well, I do certainly sometimes when I can't figure them out.
The difference is, if we really think about it, between the different flies are pretty slight. And we're talking about by sort of 8 o'clock, we're getting into the gloaming. It's, you know, not that easy for me to see. So how can this sort of primordial being with all these different things, how can it be so specific? I mean, it just blows my mind. What is it about iron blues that was tastier than medium olives, small olives? And I guess these are questions that we will never know, although I'm sure Peter Hayes has some theories.
Yeah, if you've read his book, we had him as a guest and Don on the podcast, and his book's apps. It's just one of those books that I think is everyone should consider reading if they want to get into that deeper understanding. Yes. And it debunks a lot of the myths as well, doesn't it? Which is really fascinating.
I find I've told Peter this that and out of the box, the previous book, that even though I've read his various thoughts and theories, one of them on leader strength was one that came to mind. Even though I've read them and I take all his points on board, I still find it really difficult to do it because it seems either counterintuitive or it is the opposite of what is established a law. And then the other part of it, which I joke with Peter, is that for me personally, I will never have enough time in my life to worry about presenting a fly going backwards down a river or forwards down a river. And I know he has very strong views about the fish picking them out, and I'm sure he's right, but that's almost too much of a consideration for me, because I think, well, if I'm going to imitate a fly that's coming backwards down the river, what if it catches a crosswind and suddenly turns and goes forward down the river? It's all good stuff to play with, though.
He's a great force of nature, and I remember doing a fishing stroke casting demonstration for the club a few years back now. And I was watching him the whole time, waiting to see what he would say at the end of it. Because I know one of the things I'm sure you're aware of is that not all grayling rises leave a bubble. So I said about spotting fish, and I said, often, you know, you'll see that there's a bubble if a grayling has actually risen, but not always. And then at the end of it, I said, was that okay, Peter? Was that okay? And he said, I couldn't disagree with anything. And I sort of relaxed as a result of that afterwards, which was really interesting. But yes, I would heartily recommend the books. But you're saying some really interesting stuff. And if we go back a little bit about, you're saying about the mental health aspects and how fishing helps many people on that front. And we're seeing these, and we're being told about these big spikes about people wanting to go out into the great outdoors, wanting to move towards the countryside. More people are obviously cycling. They're obviously fishing if the numbers are that I'm hearing are big. Do you think that's part of it?
I don't think there's any doubt about it, that COVID has had an impact. Unfortunately, I've been in the news game for so long that I'm cynical and suspicious of the sort of. Do you remember in the first couple of weeks of COVID, it was going to be a new world. We're going to be nice to each other. I mean, hello. That's not quite how human beings work. What more is the pity? So I took that one with a large pinch of salt, and you know, it was only a couple of weeks later before my wife was called the C word by a jogger who ran into her while ignoring the 2 meter rule, and then she decided she didn't want to go out for 2 weeks. So you know, there's a lot of nastiness out there. There's clearly some positives if people are taking out angling or walking, hiking, whatever it is, outdoors is great. I'm sure you will have noticed, because you're down in Devon a lot more, well, based there, but I had a good few weeks down in Devon and fished on the East Dart and the West Dart quite a lot. And I was horrified by how much litter and rubbish I saw. And I was also astonished by how far it was from the car parks, that people had well, the pulling in, people had done a good old hike, 35, 45 minutes away from the car park, sat down to have a lunch with, I knew, six or seven people, because all their plates and cans were just left there. And then at the end of the day, they got up, walked back to their car and drove off. And I find it astonishing that people would feel enough interest in the countryside to get off their backsides, to get in the car, to go to the countryside with a packed lunch, to get up, to walk into the countryside with the packed lunch, then have it, and then leave all the litter to go back in the car. It just broke my heart, really. So, yes, it's wonderful that people are you know, are going out there and doing more. But you know, it'd be nice if we could keep the good standards up. And it struck me that there was a disproportionately large amount of rubbish and litter around Dartmoor this summer compared to when I've been there every year for donkey's years, and I've never seen anything like it. Never seen crowds like it either at the
no. No, it's really interesting. There's that spot, you may know it, and apologies if the listeners, if we go off on a slight tangent, but there's a spot where Cherry Brook is just downhill from Prince Hall. And you'll often see people picnicking there, and somebody even had one at a gazebo there and everything, but they tidied everything up.
Yeah, that's
there.
No problem. Yeah.
And do you think it is more people who are not... they should understand this stuff for starters, but do you think it's people who have not really ventured out into the country who wanted to do it?
No, I think it's the same attitude of the jogger who runs into my wife. This is just as we're first allowed outside, you know, so everyone's super sort of 2 meters away. And for some people, they just too wrapped up in themselves, I think. I just can't understand why you'd want to go to a beautiful place and then make it less beautiful as you live. It is beyond my comprehension, and I resent doing it. I'm quite good at balsam bashing. I take that quite seriously and always try and do some, and there's plenty to do out there. But the littering, I'm much more resentful about picking it up. But I do pick it up as I walk back. And I mean, on the West Dart, I mean, I was coming back and I had armfuls. I mean, I had it stuffed down my waders, and that left a bit of a sour taste, I have to say. And I was up on the Derbyshire Wye, as I said, and many more beer cans and drink cans in the river there. It just seems so unnecessary, really, so unnecessary.
Like you say, they're such beautiful places as well. But while I've got you on Dartmoor as well, you know, for me, it was a life-changing place, literally, having read Mike Weaver's book. I threw in a job and we moved down here a few years later. Because of that picture of him fishing Cherry Brook, standing on a rock, and that was it. And I always, again, when I've done demonstrations at the Wild Trout Trust do down in Dartmoor a couple of years ago, I always tell it, and he sort of slinks off because he's a bit embarrassed. But it is, what does Dartmoor mean to you to fish, as somebody who's fished it a fair bit?
So I was a student at Exeter Uni between 84 and 87, and I was quite a rebellious student, really, because it's quite a conformist university. So I was really into my motorbike. So I had a motorbike, and I wasn't a fly fisher then, I was a course fisher. But so I would fish on the Ex and the canals, but I would ride on my motorbike out to Dartmoor and all around Dartmoor, always going up the A30 into Oakhampton, then down, because it sort of reveals itself. And the same from the Ashburton side in, and it reveals. They're my two favourite ways in. And it's just the most astonishing. Just the most astonishing place. It has its own microclimate. Cherry Brook, I can remember John Beer spending the night in his camper van. I stayed at the hotel because it was absolutely, the rain was sideways. In the hotel, this is in August, you can hear the wing of woo, woo. And and then you come off the moor and it's absolutely, it's beautiful. The sunshine, no wind. It's so harsh, the environment. That I must have fished around Cherry Brook, oh dear, maybe 10 or 12 times. I've never seen anything, no fish, no fly, just crystal clear water. And if it wasn't for people assuring me there were fish there, I'd say I just don't buy it. And I've been watching quite a lot of the YouTube videos that Devon Fly fishes up there, and realized that maybe longer, thinner leaders might help. Staying out of the water might help. That was a big step forward, actually, keeping away from the water. Casting quite a long way back from the bank, actually, and not being afraid of having your fly line go up. And all that, and then suddenly you think, okay, you start to get it. But I think overall, I'll tell you the real reason, I suppose, why it sticks in my mind, why Dartmoor is important, is the late Roddy Ray. Did you know Roddy?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So, gosh, this is so 2022, really 2003, maybe. I'd been only fishing in lakes at that point, and I was desperate to go into rivers. I didn't know what to do, so I bought some waders. I don't know what I did for a rod. I still have a big lake rod. And I thought, right, I'm going to have to pick a guide. And I thought, well, I'll go somewhere I know, Devon. And I picked Roddy Ray just at random, and we met just near Fingers Bridge. And so I caught my first – I'm just looking. I thought I had the picture behind me. I caught my first wild brown trout from the River Teen with Roddy Ray as my guide. And I caught quite a few actually that day, because he's a very good guide, and there's loads of wonderful fish there. So thinking about it, that's really, I suppose, I'm returning to my source. It's just and actually every time I go to Devon, I fish the Teen, and it's always been good to me. I love it.
Good. Fantastic. And where did fly fishing, so you said you're a course angler, you're into motorbikes, where did the fly fishing thing actually start? You said you started on still waters, which is really the sort of traditional way really into it, isn't it? Where did you start?
Well, so if I was to tell you, I've got an Angling Times hook wallet from, I think, in 1977, when you had to get the vouchers. And back then, Bob Church was the columnist for trout fishing. And despite him urging you to try reservoirs and stuff, it still came across as a sort of posh thing to do. And I was in South London, born and bred, and it just didn't seem that fly fishing, I didn't know anybody did it, I didn't know anywhere to go to do it, any reservoirs were miles away. It seemed to me it was not for me. And that was my prevailing view up until early 2000. I've been working at the Daily Mirror. They knew I was quite keen on fishing, because they always used to take the piss because they thought fishing was boring, despite the fact, of course, Mr. Crabtree, I think, originated in the, yeah. in the Mirror. And did very well for them. So they had a whip round when I left to buy me a gift, and they got quite a lot of cash. It was more than £700. And I didn't know this, and they decided, rather than give me cash, to get me a voucher for fishing. And they got me a voucher at Farlow. So I can still remember the leaving day when they presented it with me. This is so bad, because I opened the envelope and I must have, the disappointment must have been visible on my face, because I just went, oh, but it's a voucher at Farlow's. That's a fly fishing shop. I don't do that. And there was also, oh, well, we didn't know. So I thought, well, I've got 750 quid. I'll go down to Farlow's. And that's, I met Sean Clark, first time I met him. And I went away with a 9 foot, 7 weight rod, which I still have, box of flies, cheap reel, Cortland line, 444, and a book. And Sean's parting words were, just follow the book. I can't remember what it was called now. He just said, follow it religiously. He said, criticize yourself. So the right stuff is about to start. And the first few years, it's made up in Norwich. And I rent a house in Swaffham, and it's got quite a big garden. And I decide, I make a resolution. I've never been sporty. My dad would say, I had never applied myself to any kind of activity, apart from my fishing. I thought, okay, I'm going to dedicate myself to fly fishing. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to learn it, and I'm not going to give up until I've learned it. So I went into the back garden. I had afternoons free, and I'd sit there, lifting up, laying down, reading the book, always checking my wrist. I mean, I thought I had a permanent swan neck. And I must have done it for about 3 months, because I was anxious about turning up a trout lake, Narborough Trout Lake, a lovely place in Swaffham, up the road, 3 miles away. And I'd never been there, but I'd seen the sign. I was just nervous that I was going to go up there and people were going to, that I was going to make a fool of myself, or that people were, you know, the thing. Anyway, it sounds ridiculous, but I really did. I was anxious about it. 3 months in the back garden, and I was casting. I could do a single, I could faff a double haul of sorts. And I thought, right, let's go for it. So drive up to Narborough Lakes, very nice people, explain how it works, tie on a cat's whisker, pick a likely spot, cast, fly hits the water, couple of tugs, bang! My first rainbow trout is on, and as somebody who'd only course fished, I'd never had anything quite like it on a line. It was absolutely exhilarating. I got what people meant about the direct connection you get in fly fishing. Maybe only in lure fishing. Even then, so much, it seems so much more direct. And I think that means that it brings a link. They're both physical and metaphysical between you and the fish and the quarry. And I was absolutely buzzed. Narborough Lakes is up there, just up the road, and I was going back there maybe two or three times a week for the next year. And then I've never told anybody this before. It's one of the big downsides, I think, of put and take trout fisheries, is I'd have bin liners filled with dead trout, and I'd give it away to people until it, you know, until nobody wants the trout anymore. And that actually ended up putting the brakes on my lake fishing, because I just got sick of killing fish, really. It doesn't give me any pleasure. I understand the business of it, and I'm not squeamish, but it's not something that I enjoyed. And I'm really glad that, having made the switch to rivers, apart from charity days, I've never been back to a still water, and apart from a distressed fish in Slovenia, I've never killed a trout either.
That's really interesting. That it sounds a very similar path to myself. And I remember the first I caught on a still water, and I took it and I went home, and the guy said, "Where are you going?" And I was just so astounded. I'd caught a fish that I was in shock. And he said, "Well, have another go." And I caught another one, and that was it. And exactly the same. And for my birthday, some friends, it was interesting what you said about the fish, because friends would come round and you'd pass them a rainbow trout, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But some friends very sweetly clubbed together and bought me a cold smoker. And so I'd smoke them, and they went down really well with people, I have to say. And it turns out the smoker comes from Crediton, which is just down the road from where I live now. It's funny how this little world is really small, and I know the person who owns it now, and it's really funny how these things work. But it becomes a passion, doesn't it? And I remember Narborough because it had some of the Nar running through it, didn't it?
Right. Which
and did you get to fish that?
I joined Salmon and Trout Conservation UK. I can't remember what its previous name was, but I joined it as a previous name because someone had told me it would give you access to the River Nar. And there was a number there, and I phoned the bloke up, and I was honest about, because at this point I'd only fished in the lakes, and he pretty much told me not to bother going on the Nar. And I wouldn't say he did it in a particularly polite way either, really. So that stuck in my mind. So no, I've never fished the Nar. I've seen from Charles Rangeley Wilson now, I mean, some of the Norfolk rivers are in truly amazing condition. I mean, and I also learned something else when I was living in Swaffham, outside Swaffham, which I've not put to the test, but Charles has assured me is true, which is Norfolk is one of the best sea trout counties in the country, but you just getting on it is a game all to itself, and I was only there for just under 2 years, and I was certainly hearing from people saying, "Oh yeah, the sea trout fishing is amazing," so I still don't know how to get on it, whether there's any free bits anywhere that people can use, but I have heard wonderful things about it.
Yeah, it's one of those places I've scratched around trying to see if you can get access to, and it's amazing. And I seem to remember a picture of a guy the river, would that be the Wensum that runs through the middle of Norwich?
The Wensum's through Norwich, yeah, and I've caught trout in there. Yeah. The Wensum north of Norwich.
There was a guy course fishing by the station there, by the hotel that runs by the, and he caught some massive great sea trout, didn't he? I think it was like 7-8 pound or something course fishing.
There's plenty there. I've seen trout up to, I'm trying to remember the name of the village, about 7-8 miles north of Norwich. And I've caught trout from there. It's a beautiful, I mean, I love living there. Absolutely love living there. Miss it. That was the end of the lake and small still waters.
So rivers came into your life. And where did that happen? Was it sort of where did you first sort of cast a fly to fish on moving water?
So it was at Fingal's Bridge.
Of course,
Roddy Ray, and so I did a weekend with him. A weekend with him, and I think there may have been an advert in the back of Trout and Salmon for Long Parish, Syndicate on the Test. And as I was pretty flush then, single bloke on telly, I thought, all right, I'll take out a 30-day membership, Syndicate. And then it was £1,800. And I stayed there for about the next 8 years, and I left when it was getting on for £3,000. Wow. And it was lovely because it's close, relatively close. I could get there in 1 hour and 10 pretty much every time. It's beautiful. I like cricket. There's a village cricket team up there, and I used to watch them from one of the beats. And it was really lovely. In the end of the day, the money was the prohibitive factor. That was what ultimately sent me away from it. But there is, I'm not that, but I know from Fly Culture magazine, and it's very much your ethos, but I'm just not interested in catching big lumps of fish that have been chucked in there to be caught. It's all right. It just doesn't do it for me. I mean, they banned nymphing there until beginning of July to give the fish a break, in essence, because it was only in the early part of the season they'd stay down and they couldn't be caught, and then as soon as the flies started, they just didn't find it very satisfying, really. But I know it was beautiful, and I get the sort of aesthetic of it completely. The thing that really sort of started turning me on was having enjoyed the time with Roddy Ray, and God rest his soul, I got a sort of taste for sort of going out to different places, and first of all with guides and gillies, and then I got a bit more confidence just going out on my own. And then the Y and Us passport scheme became my sort of second home to the Test, really. And as long as I was minus a girlfriend, I used to have school teacher-sized summer holidays, 7 weeks. And I did about 5 weeks camping all around Bilth Wells to Abergavenny, all around that area, and fishing everything around it. And it was a wonderful time. Started talking to myself. Just wonderful. I mean, things on that. I remember on the Humvee, climbing up a bank for lunch, quite hot. And as I put my head up, right in front of me is a red kite dismembering a small rabbit. There. And it's as startled as I am. And it just opens its wings. It's a massive thing, absolutely massive thing. It sort of disappears over. I mean, these are extraordinary things to see. And even though mink are horrible, mean-spirited, nasty, nasty, horrible things, it's still quite extraordinary sometimes to have one eyeball you from the other bank and sort of follow you around. Although I'd much rather it was an otter. Still haven't seen one though.
Yeah, you should come to the tour. There's a few knocking around. I never had the heart to tell people when they'd seen a mink, when I'm with them, it's an otter, and I didn't have the heart to tell them it was a mink. But they seem to have come back a little bit stronger here now, and I'm not seeing so many mink and more otter. And there's one guy I guided one time. We were on the mole in the morning. We saw an otter. And we were on the tour in the afternoon. We saw an otter there. So he's clearly the otter magnet.
Can I ask you where you are on beavers? As this summer I was trying to fish the free section of the otter south of Honiton. And the weather is just too, the river's always in spate every time. However, while I was down there, I met other anglers who were walking around, and I was, I'll hold back. They were talking about beavers. I'll be interested in your view before I tell you what.
The honest answer is the jury's very much out for me. That's not me trying to be safe. I haven't really come across them. I've seen signs of them on the Tamer system down in Cornwall. We haven't got them on our system. You could put arguments for large woody debris,
yeah,
and the trees in there. If you look at the States, beaver ponds are really highly priced to fish.
Yeah.
But what that does to the system as a whole, there are going to be people. I think sometimes you've got to let nature do its thing. And man and woman always intend really well, but what they want is for their use, not for everyone else as well. So I haven't encountered them yet. It will be interesting to see if I came across a beaver pond, how I would feel about it. So I'm not 100% sure yet, but where are you with it?
Well, I was of the, certainly, I've spoken to the people that have been reintroduced to them in the Devon Wildlife Trust and so on. And the conversations had always been, I was under the impression it's all fairly limited, both in terms of, this is in the initial reintroduction, both in terms of monitoring and also protecting the beavers from people who may not want them around or other reasons. And so I thought, well, you know, Devon and Cornwall are fairly big places. There's got to be room for beavers as well as everybody and everything else, and I was just all the opinion I encountered from anglers both on the sea for sea bass and around was all negative. And despite the fact that people said they knew where they were, but I'm not entirely sure how much of it was true. The people that seemed to know most about it were concerned that they felt they were breeding, that they were going to be spreading, and that if they weren't allowed to spread, then the whole thing became pointless anyway, and why not just keep them in people's back gardens? I was surprised by the degree of hostility. And I think history has told us that country folk can be quite resistant, I think, sometimes too. I mean, I know reintroduction of birds of prey and such like are terrible times. And the claims made by the sheep farmers about how many lambs are taken, I struggle. I just struggle to buy them. Mm. Yeah.
I suppose one of the arguments as well is that beavers and trout were here before and they seem to be doing fine just before that. And it is a natural knee-jerk to go into overdrive against them, isn't it, when something yeah. like this happens. And, you know, people say similar things. And funnily enough, I remember when I was with the otter magnet, Dominic, his name was, when I was with him, he said, oh, well, that's the pool ruined. And I said, well, I'm not so sure. And the trout continued to rise and we caught fish.
Yeah.
So I'm all for giving everything a bit of a chance and see what happens. And it'll be really interesting to see. But I think it's easy, isn't it, to go into that downswing about it and think, right, this is the end of the world. This is the end of the world. And I'd like to see how it plays out a little bit longer term, I think.
Yeah. Yes, I talk about belief because I don't know, because I haven't seen, because it's all the places where the beavers are and they're sort of supposed to be secret and so forth. But until there's actually a visible problem, an actual real problem, I think it's a good thing, a really positive thing. Makes people talking about rivers, and you know, it's a good news story by and large.
Yeah, and it's interesting we're going down this sort of direction that you mentioned, salmon and trout conservation. And I think he's been a guest on here, and I'm sure you know him, Nick Meesham, as well. Yeah. He's really hit the ground running, and how the work that he's actually doing right now, I think, is fantastic as well. And they're being really, really proactive. And we're starting to see that as well. And we'll come on to obviously the work that Fergal's doing as well with highlighting it. Do you think that you're seeing anglers more engaged with the environment and all the things, the not so good stuff that's going on right now? Are you sensing they're more engaged with that now?
Absolutely, and not just anglers. And that's the critical part of the story, because I think there's been well-meaning anglers for decades have been banging the drum about salmon farms. I met Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull, who famously used to salmon farm, and I said, you don't salmon farm anymore. And he said, no. He said, I stopped when I found out, just how negative they were. You can take that with a pinch of salt or not, but he didn't have a good word to say about them, having run one. I think Nick and Paul, his predecessor, have been very focused on the salmon farming issue all the way through it, and rightly so, very specific and extremely damaging to the wild salmon stocks. What's changed in more recent times, I'm going to say the B word. Fergal would probably not use the B word, but I think it starts off with Brexit, the notion of Brexit. And it doesn't matter whether you're pro or anti-Brexit. The one thing that Brexit was going to do for the environment was it was going to change, European directives were going to go out the window. Knowing that the UK government has repeatedly infringed European directives and been dragged to court for it, doesn't suggest, to me at least, that when we're completely free of these frameworks, that new frameworks will be in place that offer higher safeguards. And lo and behold, we're already seeing with food standards, aren't we? Michael Gove, over the last couple of weeks, has been pretty much knocking those into touch, despite the promises that we were going to have the highest standards around. More concerning still, and it's related to that, is the state of the Environment Agency. I feel bad giving them another kicking, because every time I've encountered members of staff from the Environment Agency, it has been at events, normally at the House of Commons, where they are just kicked by everybody for their total failure to do what they're supposed to do, protect the environment, stand up for the environment. But they are hopelessly inadequate and hopelessly underfunded and very, very badly managed. And I read the other day that as we leave the transition period, there's going to be a unspecified period where there will be no Environment Agency at all. There's going to be a sort of hole. And I'm worried about what's going to come into that vacuum. I do see positives. Now, Fergal is a much more a glass half full man compared to my half empty. And he sees opportunity to right the wrongs, really. So he's been on the Environment Agency's case. He's calling them to task all the time. And because of his profile and the style with which he's doing it, he's garnering a lot of support. And this is where I'm really interested. Across the board of the scientific community, he's got loads of professors and other academics backing him up. And then you've got the wider community as well, loads of high-profile journalists, Monbiot and so on. So he's really sort of getting the message across. And within that, there's the role of the water companies. And Fergal and I have the same view that water is essentially too cheap for consumers. And by that, I mean there's not enough money going into the water system, both in terms of distributing water, building up supplies, distributing it. Too much money still going out to shareholders. And until we get the balance right, I think that's the water companies could do so much more, but they, as history has shown us, they will resist every inch of the way until they are forced to do something. And I won't go through all the details now, because I'm sure Fergal and you have spoken about them before, but Fergal with Amwell Magna has really focused. He's just focused on all the failings of the water company and the Environment Agency. He's pursued them doggedly and legally. And the net result has been hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of improvements to the River Lea. Still not enough. There's still sewage going through. There's still too much abstraction. But as a point of principle, the endless deprivation and destruction that the water companies have sort of presided over since privatisation has stopped on the Lea, and some good is going back in. And when I said, oh, it's amazing, how do you get hundreds of thousands of pounds, you know, out of these people? And folks said, you've got to remember, it's not money that we've been given as some kind of prize. This is the money that they should have been putting in for decades. And I just on one final point on this, because it has been that what Fergal has done on the River Lea, I'm now seeing other water charities or organisations, protective organisations, are all looking at what Fergal's done on the Lea and thinking, well, if he's done it on the Lea, exactly the same problems apply on the River Chess, for example. Let's have a go at doing it there. So I'm guessing, but I'm pretty sure that the Environment Agency and the water companies are at the moment on a back foot like never before, thanks to people power. It's been brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And I think you hit the nail on the head with engaging people on a wider basis. And I think as we come into Christmas, the salmon thing we've got to do, haven't we? And we owe it to everyone to let them know what's going on, these practices, how it's not good for you. And I'm going to try and get somebody on just November time that we can talk about that some more. And perhaps, and that's, you know, leads us on to social media a little bit. And that's where these sorts of things have worked really, really well, haven't they? That it's enabled people to let, and if it's people like yourself and Fergal saying these things, people stand up and listen, don't they?
Well, I suppose old media, newspapers, television and radio, just reduce the platform available, not just to anglers, but to anybody sort of interested in water, subsurface and above. There was no platform. I mean, Countryfile, again, I think in many ways is responding to what it's seeing on social media and new media. And is, thanks to people like Joe Crowley, he's doing a lot more on sort of water-based environmental issues, which is wonderful. And yes, I think you're right that where there was no platform or an ever-shrinking platform in the old media, now people like looking at beautiful nature videos. Oh, Johnny Gray, Professor Johnny Gray does a lot of a river clearance and river management for the Wild Trout Trust. He's always posting, here we are taking out another weir. And, you know, sometimes you think a couple of volunteers going out with, pickaxes and spades and putting right some Victorian rumble. There's other ones, huge group JCBs and tons of gravel. And it's really interesting that his work finally gets a sort of public platform. And, yeah, that's thanks to the technology and these podcasts and such like.
Yeah, it's the great thing, because it is, I was going to say how social media has changed the world, really. I'm looking at our tiny little world of fishing, but it has, hasn't it, forever. And you can get information immediately. And I've talked before on these things about, you know, as you said, actually, with the book, that you would learn to cast with the book. And now you can just get your phone up, right? And the standard has changed. People can learn more quickly about many things, can't they?
Yes, yes, they can. I was going to say, fly fishing, obviously, fly tying, to be able to slow everything down. That is amazing. Wonderful. I just on a tangential note, I'm really into sort of old motorcycles, and I'd never done a full gearbox restoration, but I watched a couple of, one YouTube video 10 times. It was the most extraordinary experience because, as I took the gearbox apart, it was as if I'd done it. It was so familiar to me. I knew what to do, but I'd never done it before. And took it all out, cleaned it up, inspected it, put it all back, I put it back in, tied it on. Bloody hell! I don't know how a gearbox works, but I can take one apart and put it back together again. It's an amazing resource, amazing resource. There's lots of downsides to it as well, of course, which is, you know, I'm guarded about places on the Usk that I'd go fishing because I don't want to draw people, too many people to them. I'm mad on my bone fishing, and I've already seen how angling pressure, not just pressure, but angling pressure, but it's had a significant impact. I think in Cuba I've seen how the fishing has changed, not as it once was, in my view. And so I've been very lucky to explore lots of bits of the Caribbean that people don't normally go to. And my God, there's tons and tons and tons and tons of it out there, but it takes time to get to the places. Right, it's cheaper and more affordable, but it takes you more time to do it. So the old, you know, week long package holiday of fishing, 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 which is a brilliant buzz, that's going to be the thing that suits people with full time jobs. But if you get 3 months off and bumming around the Caribbean, it's a lovely thing to do.
That sounds very civilized, very, very civilized. It's interesting coming back to that, because I'm going to bring this, you'll see how hopefully I bring this together, that yesterday we were talking and, you know, we were talking about spey casting and exactly that, where I'd get Simon Gawsworth's spey casting book out. Right, that's the first bit. Do that, run in, look at it. Right, that's the next bit, run in and do all these sorts of things. And how I said about my wife, Emma, how she was going on a canal boat with her aunt and grandmother. She learned how to open a lock from YouTube.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I thought of that. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, there's nothing you can't do now, as you say, with motorbikes and everything else. But that brings me on really nicely, because one of the people I was talking to about it was Luke Bannister. And before we started chatting, that we were chatting off mic and chatting about his rods, and we're fans of his rods, and he's been a guest on the podcast as well. Bamboo, how did that come to you, and do you enjoy fishing it? Do you fish it a lot?
I broke it on the West Dart early August. It was a really unfair falling over. I was on the bank, and I'd slipped on them. It was just a little round, like a sort of nipple-shaped rock, for want of a better word. You wouldn't have noticed it, obviously. Slipped on that, and as I went down, my left knee went down on another nipple-shaped rock that you also didn't see, but it went straight up. Oh, God. I didn't even realise as I'd gone down, the rod had gone through the trees, and so that was my lovely Luke rod broken. The lovely thing about Bamboo, of course, with Luke is that he can repair and fix, so he's making good for me even as we speak. What brought me to it? Well, one was being able to afford to do it and probably having more money than sense. I was really, you know, fishing art and fishing books. I'm committed to it. I love my fish. So I thought, well, I'm actually going to have to try a bamboo rod. I bought one, first of all, an old one on eBay, a creaky old thing, for £50, heavy. And horrible. And then someone said, oh, you need to try a modern one because it's old style materials, but with actually quite a modern feel. And I sort of looked around and I saw Luke Bannister advertising in Wild Trout Trust, I think it was, in their magazine. And I thought, oh, I'll give him a call. So I spoke to him, loved him immediately. Really just a really mellow guy, just the kind of person you'd want to be an artisan rod maker. The project then becomes sort of toing and froing, and it's a really nice sort of conversational thing you build up as the rod's created over a period of months, then eventually it's ready. And I said, rather than you send it up, I'll come down to Devon and meet you and we'll give it a go. It took a while, a bit of getting used to. I fished with glass fibre rods, which are very wobbly, gooey things. And this, I would say that the taper, this is super fast taper, so there's quite a lot of strength in the lower part of the rod and quite a degree of flex in the sort of upper fifth, I should say. So it requires a sort of a little bit faster wrist action to get the best out of it. But it's a delight to use. I did worry about breaking it, but I thought, well, if you've got one, you've got to fish with it. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to go with a cane rod, maybe I should try a silk line. So I then found a Torenzio Italian line maker. And rather than buy a silk one, I thought I'd buy the artificial silk because I thought just silk's bound to go wrong with me. The combination of the two is a bit of a game changer, really, because I've never seen a silk line before, but the diameter is a fraction of what the water lines are like, and consequently it cuts through the wind as if there is no wind, and it lands, I'd like to think, on the water very lightly. It picks off lightly until it gets heavy and wet. And so I now, if I fish under 4 hours, I will fish with a synthetic line, And if I'm going to fish for a longer day, then I'll go out with, I'll fish with a woven line. And if it's a longer day, I'll go out with a plastic line. I started off with loads of gear, loads of flies. And now I try and go out with, bone fishing, I go out with five flies, one spool of tippet, and my pliers, and the rest is water. And that's all I take. And I found that I don't miss anything, don't need anything. Water is all you need, really, and suntan lotion. And with trout fishing, I think it was, may have been the Patagonia. I can't remember. Somebody decided that rather than take out loads and loads of flies, they were going to fish one pattern in all forms, yeah, across all species. And I can't remember what it was, a brownie thing. And
pheasant tail.
There was a pheasant tail, was it?
Yeah. It's Yvonne Chonard from Patagonia.
And he did everything from brown trout to bonefish on it, I think, if I remember, yeah, right. Yeah. Or permit even, I think. Oh, amazing. Yeah. So I read this article. I thought, well, I'm going to give that a go. And another thing I got very interested in was using waste materials for fly tying. So dubbing out of our tumble dryer, plastic off electric cables, amazing for bodies. I mean, amazing for bodies. Mm. Red plastic wrap around, it's a buzzer. Yeah. And I've been really enjoying less is more and creative solutions. I love that fewer flies. I don't think I've got the nerve to just fish one pattern, but fascinating. Because he said at the end, he wasn't entirely sure whether he caught any more or any less. It was just the same.
Yeah, you don't. And that's that thing we were talking about previously, isn't it? It's not just about the fish, is it? It's everything else. And they're a happy byproduct. And I know, I think I may have mentioned it on here before, I fished one fly for a season.
Did you? Okay.
And exactly the same. It was just a black clinkhammer on the Crediton Club waters, and it worked just fine for me. And I find I carry less and less and less. There are times, aren't there, when you're fishing somewhere new that you feel you should have something. But I did another demo somewhere or other, and I just handed out my fly box and said, I think if I'm really lucky, I reckon I could catch trout just about anywhere with these flies that I've got here. I was more worried people were going to nick them more than anything else, because there's much nicer people tied some for me. But it is confidence, isn't it? And it comes back to some of the things that I've talked about in previous ones as well. The presentation of the fly.
Presentation of the fly. And another thing I've sort of learned to accept more on the bone fishing, I suppose, is there's sometimes the fish aren't on the feed, and it doesn't matter if you can see them, and you present the fly to them all day long. And you can sometimes stimulate, but there are days, and I think you just have to accept that the fish are not on the feed, and that's the way it is. And yeah, and then you can have fun doing other stuff or taking it in nature. So I think that's when you say about the confidence, it's if you were to, you know, turn up, not see any hatch, not turn over rocks, not see anything, and, you know, I don't know what to use or try. I think, you know, if you present any fly well, and the fish are on it, you should get some kind of reaction. If you present a fly well and you don't get any reaction, it is possible. I think I now will accept it sometimes. The fish just aren't on the feed. So V formations on bonefish, you see them coming through to you sometimes, and you think, bloody hell, how can I fail? They're coming right at me. I can take them off on the side. I can pick them in the middle. You put a fly down and they just go straight over it. They're not feeding. They're leaving. And that's the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And that permit takes that to another level again, doesn't it?
So all the received wisdom in the world, they're behind you. I've got permit books up about this high. I became obsessed with trying to catch a permit, as everybody does, primarily because everybody goes on about how hard they are to catch. I've skimmed through the Cuban trips and present the fly perfectly. The permit, I've never known a fish follow a fly so close. It follows it that close for 30 yards. You pull the thing, I could have tailed it in from the boat, wouldn't swallow the fly. The day I caught one, I've got a fluey-type bug. I feel dreadful, dreadful. I'm just sitting in the boat. We've been in lagoons looking for bonefish, and the guy says, oh, let's go out and look for a permit. My wife's there. He says, oh, I don't want to sit on the front of the boat if we're going outside. It's too wavy. Oh, God. I really did feel bad. I got up. We've been out for about 10 minutes, and I'm out, and I think, oh, there's a three permit there. Many little ones. And I sort of got the fly in your hand, this fly line around my feet, and I sort of just chucked it over like that. The guide hasn't even seen the permit. he sees me throwing it in, and he sees that I've missed the permit by maybe 6, 7, 8 feet or more. And one of them just turns around, swims down, and takes this fly, hooks itself, and swims off into the distance. So that's my permit story. I didn't really cast, didn't really hook it. And I'm really glad I caught one because I don't have to waste any more time. I mean, they're magnificent fish, but they are magnificent fish. I mean, but I've got a friend, and he fishes for carp on the tidal stretch of the River Thames, just around Richmond. And he catches maybe 2 a year, and he does about 2,000 hours each year. And that's what I don't want to end up doing, is that amount of time for so little reward.
Yeah, no, I he gets nothing but my respect for it. Permit stories, my permit, I've been lucky to catch a few, but my first one, I took a group down to Belize, and it was experienced saltwater anglers who had caught loads of bonefish. And we said, look, there's other stuff on the menu, but let's see if we can find a permit. And we caught lots of other stuff. There were permit everywhere. We couldn't get them to eat. And the last day, I got up at 4:30 with Martin. I sat in the boat while he made perfect cast after perfect cast. Nothing would eat. And I sat and watched, being the dutiful host, as you do. And then at the end of the day, he said, why don't you have a go? And it was one of the worst casts I've ever made in this thing. I was trying to kick it off, and I could feel his eyes burning into the back of my head. And there was one permit caught that week, and I was the lucky one. But I felt terrible. I felt absolutely terrible. And he'd done everything perfectly. Everyone else could fish, and we just couldn't. Yet I went back. And I worked for a couple out there. They'd never saltwater fished in their lives. Same place, 2 hours, both had permit.
This is amazing. It is amazing.
I was sort of standing at the front, and the guide was at the back, and we're leaping up and down, and they couldn't believe, what's the big deal? We've caught permit. And it was, unbelievable. But special fish, aren't they?
They are very, their behaviour is just extraordinary. One minute they're there, the next minute they're gone. Some of them are the size of dustbin lids. I mean, they're absolutely enormous. But the constantly moving around, trying to work out, because when you're in the time just lifting up for the cast, they've already done that 3 or 4 times. It's just so hard. But I'm of the view that it doesn't matter about the cast, and your story kind of corroborates it. If they want to eat, they want to eat. And the one I caught wanted to eat the shrimp. Thankfully.
Yeah. Now we're going to move on and start, because we've been chatting over an hour, and we'll start to wind things down. But one of the things, we're similar age. I think there's a year between us. But I notice your love of hawkwind. And I can't see where that came from, so I need to understand where that came from.
Okay, well, it's a two-phase thing. It was, my dad always liked his sort of psychedelic rock. So I was sort of Moody Blues and early Floyd we grew up to. And then at school, before punk rock, I suppose just before punk rock made any mark, I didn't have an older brother, but my friends' older brothers were broadly all into sort of Thin Lizzy, Hawkwind, Santana, Genesis, Led Zeppelin, and that sort of percolated through. There was another, I was running into problems in Croydon with a bit of sort of violence with the, it could be quite hairy at times, and I decided to align myself with the bikers in Croydon, and because I was interested in bikes again, my dad was mad on motorcycles too, and the violence stopped, which was great, and blow me, they all loved Hawkwind. And then things got very wonky, because I then started getting into another band called Here and Now, which was of a similar sort of genre, and that in turn led me into sort of free festivals and then travelers and then some really crazy, wonderful times. And then I got to know Hawkwind as people about 20 years ago, and then became really good friends And then I've ended up singing with them on stage, and I've written tracks on their albums. I've got a silver disc in the toilet. And I mean, I was listening to them this morning. I mean, I just find it absolutely absorbing music. It's the kind of music. It's the old cliche. It makes you feel high when you're stone cold sober. It really does. It's nice. Astonishing. Love it. And they're lovely people as well. Lovely people. Crazy, nice. As you can imagine. Do you like them? Then? Have you seen them?
No. No. That's why I couldn't understand it.
Pete. You could be the keyboard player with that t-shirt. No.
I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Oh, it's the special. Just seen.
Yes, absolutely. I love them.
Well, it's the, now I'm going to get this right, 41st anniversary, I think. I think this weekend of the first album. Amazing, Beth.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It was that first album particularly. I think they went off in another direction too quickly with more specials. But the first one, and I remember the two-tone tours and seeing those and even the Body Snatchers, and, you know, they were just the whole movement and what it stood for. And it even now resonates, doesn't it? And what they were talking about made sense.
Especially, I mean, there's a... It's quite clear that this country is has got some very nasty sort of racist undercurrents that are less in the undercurrent and more bubbling to the surface these days. And I really thought with Two Tone that we were going to leave all that behind. I sound as naive as the people saying that COVID was going to make us all nicer people now.
Yeah.
Just what can you say?
Yeah.
What can
you say? Yeah. Really strange. Really strange. It was lovely. I took my daughter. Her first concert was Madness. It was at Westonbirt Arboretum, and we got up the front and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And there was a lot of that. And when we were getting out, it was some young lad was directing the traffic because it was horrific getting out. He let us out because I was chatting to him and the thing. He said, "Is this your first time at Madness?" And I said, "No, I've been following him since 1979. And he was like, his parents probably weren't even born when that came out. So it was kind of cool to do that. I still love that. It's lovely. One of the guests I had on here, actually, I don't know when you fish, do you listen to music?
No, I don't. I have listened to, on the Wiley sometimes, to while away the hours and I'm not catching anything, I will occasionally put Test Match Special on. And I find that very... because cricket and trout fishing, for me, that's summertime. That's the summer, and sometimes the two of them together is a nice vibe. You don't have to concentrate too much on either. You can roll between the two. I've got a friend, and he's really keen on music bone fishing. Never cross my mind really.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember actually one of our guests on here, and again in our book podcast, Boo Gilbraith, listens to a lot of music. And I remember we were fishing the Devon, and there was a young lad there, and he had his headphones on. He was smoking something illegal, I think, and having a ball, you know. He was just having a ball, and it was really cool.
I'm not going to be a snob about it, but it is going to sound snobby, but on a river, I just think you'd be missing out. I really do. I think I'd want to hear what's around me. I can get it on the tropics. That wind is a bit, can be a bit wearing. But it never crossed my mind. Never crossed my mind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's start winding this up then. So you've got one day of fishing. Where's it going to be?
Left in my life.
Yeah.
Then that would be a no-brainer. I would be off to North Caicos and the Turks and Caicos Islands, and I'd go fishing with my friend David Kennedy, who has a beautiful bonefish tattoo down his arm, which says all you really need to know. And we go out. There's a lagoon on the island, about 12 miles long, 2 miles wide. Mangroves at the far side, so you have a long old hike over to sometimes the best areas, or they can be right near you. And we're going to spend the day there. Walking, just we paddle across a channel, maybe 20 yards across, and then you walk the rest of the day. 6-7 miles until your feet. I go bare feet as well, which is
because that's high risk.
The lagoon is safe because and it's fine. The shells, ground up bits of shells, can get to you in the end, but it's a love. I think personally, swimming trunks and barefoot. That'll be my last and final day.
Nice. Well, let's wrap this up then with, and I think I know the answer, but are you loving fly fishing as much as you always have?
More. And this loops us right back to the beginning. There's a lovely guy called John Slater you may have met, and he's getting on a bit now, retired bank manager, and loves his fishing, works as a guide sometimes. And he says nowadays he really doesn't really fish that much, does a bit of roach fishing on a centre pin in an evening hour, but he loves guiding, he loves photography, always down on the rivers with his cameras. And then actually the river has just become a sort of conduit, and fly fishing has become a conduit to a different sort of pace and style of life. And I found that that trout fishing is a conduit for me. And my wife fly fishes. My daughter's only two, or coming up two, but she will fly fish. She doesn't know it yet. We will hopefully spend some time in the Caribbean if coronavirus allows us to, and a good length of time out there. And that's because of fishing, and we've got friends out there, friends here, and it's got its tentacles in all aspects of our life, and it's all enjoyable. There are no downsides to it at all. That's it. Love it.
Fantastic. Matthew, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me this morning. It's been absolutely brilliant. We've covered, I had some stuff and we've gone off on tangents, which I love doing.
One day.
Yeah. But thank you so much for taking the time to be a guest. It's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone, this has been the Fly Culture Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Did you know you can now see this in glorious YouTube now as well? So I sort of edit it and send that out. So that usually goes out a day or so later than I put the actual podcast out. But I hope you'll enjoy that and viewing that and watching us chat as well. Thank you for supporting Fly Culture. It really does mean a lot to us. And I'm really thrilled to say that now, you know, we're starting to sell out of more copies of it. Issue one now will be a collector's piece. So that's sold out now. So I'm thrilled about that. And thank you, everyone who takes the time to write to say how much they've enjoyed it. It really does mean a lot. And I always make sure I reply. So thank you. But this is Pete Tigers. This has been the Fly Culture Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
The Fly Culture Podcast is brought to you in association with Fly Culture, a quarterly print magazine. For more information, please visit flyculturemag.com. You can also find Fly Culture on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.